Presenting Danforth Dialogues, a monthly podcast on leadership, hosted by Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. This month, we are pleased to have Pfizer CEO, Dr. Albert Bourla. A 30-year Pfizer employee, Dr. Bourla became CEO of the company in January of 2019 and has accelerated Pfizer's transformation to become a more science-driven, innovative company, divesting its non-science-based businesses and dramatically increasing its research and development and digital innovation budgets, refusing to accept public funding and instead investing more than $2 billion at risk. Dr. Bourla inspired colleagues to deliver a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine in just 8 months, a process that typically takes 8 to 10 years, without compromising quality or integrity. A doctor of veterinary medicine, Dr. Bourla joined Pfizer in 1993 and held roles of increasing responsibility before being named COO in 2018. In 2021, he was named CEO of the Year by CNN Business, included in Insider Magazine's Most Transformative CEO list, and inducted into the Crain's New York Business Hall of Fame. Dr. Montgomery Rice and Dr. Bourla will discuss leadership lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic and the continued challenge of achieving global health equity. Now, for this month's episode, here is Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice.
Hello, welcome to the Danforth Dialogues. As you know, our podcast is grounded in exploring the leadership lessons from the COVID-19 pandemic. And we could not have a better guest today to give us insight from the front lines in the battle to contain the virus than Dr. Albert Bourla. Now, first of all, may I call you Albert?
Thank you very much for suggesting that. We're going to ask you to call me Albert.
I am pretty sure that when the historians look back at this period in the world's history, Albert and his team at Pfizer will surely be seen as some of the heroes in ending this pandemic. So before we discuss the lessons learned from the pandemic, as a CEO, I have to ask you how you decided that Pfizer would put up $2 billion. Yes, that's billion with the B, to develop a vaccine, especially since the mRNA was new technology, and no one had ever really developed a vaccine as quickly as you did. So no matter how you look at it, that was a big bet. How did you decide to make that big bet?
Let's start with how I decided that we go all in, because that was the number one decision. It was an easy one. Let's try to remember the times we were living. There was darkness in the world. People had lost hope. We were thinking that the civilization, the way we know it, is coming to an end. So a company like ours that has the capabilities maybe to produce the solution, as challenging that could look like, we had an obligation to go and do it. So there was very easy decision that we go all in. So for that, I didn't hesitate a single moment when I said, we go all, and we don't take money from the government, and we are going to do it alone because speed is of essence. Now there is many other decisions once you decide you are all in. How are you going to do it?
Right.
And on the vaccines, you're right. The mRNA was a technology that was untested at that time. There was not a single product, vaccine or medicine, that had been produced with mRNA. It was never manufactured before. And it was the suggestion of my vaccines team to me. When I asked them to come with a plan, to me they came and they told me that we want to use mRNA. I was very puzzled when I heard their recommendation. I questioned it. I said, you must be kidding me. How you want me to put the future of the world on and months of effort in a technology that has never delivered before? And then they start explaining to me why they think that's the best way of going. And they convinced me. And I took the bet. Keep in mind that the vaccinologists are typically conservative people.
Ooh, yes.
Why? Because they are dealing with products that they go into healthy people. So when all your life you're producing something to give to someone who is healthy so that he can maintain his health, you become very conservative in the way that you think about things. So when these people were telling me, let's go for mRNA, I realized that probably they really believe that that's the best way going forward, and then I listened to them.
So, you know, Abrick, this is a podcast about leadership. And I'm going to get to, you know, my common questions about the three things you learned, et cetera. But what I am hearing, one of the values of being a good leader is listening, but then also questioning. And then once you get on board, how you rally the team. So tell me how you rallied your internal team to really get behind this unproven technology that they were convinced that would make a difference, but we knew that this would be going into healthy people. And we had to put all of that in the context of the environment that we were living in. So how did you rally the team and then keep them lifted up in order to push at such a rapid pace?
The number one success factor in cases like that, it is the motivation, and it is how much people are going to give their whole into that. And again, that was not that difficult given the conditions we were living. I kept reminding everyone that, you know, what we are doing is going to save lives, that grandparents will see grandkids, and a month later means that many people dead, and things that would make people really ready, and they were doing it, jump into the fire to make sure that there is success. So that was one and very important. The thing that was most challenging, it was that goodwill is always okay. You need a lot of money. So I gave basically an open checkbook. I would say, don't worry about the typical things that we do when we calculate projects, the return on investment. That's very special project. It's not business as usual. We go all in. It's not a question of if it is productive, the investment. It is a question if the investment will bring it earlier. The third thing that was quite challenging is to try to understand how bureaucracy operates, works in big operations like us. Usually, peers, they have to make decisions because all these projects are multidisciplinary projects. So you can't just be an early researcher. You need to be also someone that does manufacturing. There are a lot of legal issues that needs to be taken into consideration. Then you need the chemical engineers that they are going to. So it's a huge number of disciplines that they need to meet and agree. But usually when in big corporations there's a disagreement, things are frozen because someone disagrees and then there is not a mechanism to overcome other than escalating to the top. And usually they take their time before they escalate to higher levels of management because they want to make sure that they will not be embarrassed, that they didn't resolve it themselves. And then when they decide to take it up, then a second round of the same peers trying to make a decision and if someone disagrees. So I knew that this cannot happen. So I created a very big working team that was having multiple levels of management. So it was going from the people that were really doing the job all the way to those that were making decisions that basically were reporting to me on a need-to-be basis. So not because you are part of the reporting chain, you are automatically there. The second thing, it was from all disciplines, not only multi-layer, but also multidiscipline. And I was in the room. So I became the project manager. The thing that we could paralyze because a decision cannot be made was not anymore the case. So everything, every 2 weeks, we were meeting. So they didn't even have time to prepare presentations and PowerPoint. They would come with very brief slides, which is this is what needs to be decided. They would debate it in front of me. Those that they were thinking, let's do it, they would say why. Those that are thinking, let's not do it, why, and then at the end of the day, I was making a decision, and things were moving very fast. So that's how I did it. It was a lot of money at their disposal, a huge motivation factor for them to save the world, and everything I could do to reduce bureaucracy and have fast decision making.
So let's talk about that bureaucracy, because you actually ended up partnering with the NIH and working with the Vaccine Development Center there. And, you know, we're privileged to have Dr. Barney Graham now on our faculty once he retired from the NIH. And we've heard multiple versions from him of how things happened during that rapid period once the sequence was obtained from our colleagues over in China. And I think it would be appropriate for you to give us a perspective of also what was happening on the parallel track with you all's partnership and at Pfizer once that sequence was known.
And keep in mind that also ourselves, we had a partner in Germany, the BioNTech.
That's right.
That they had the intellectual property on the mRNA platform that we're going to use. We had our hands around this platform, technically and scientifically, because we had licensed it from them to develop a flu vaccine back in 2018. So when COVID hit, we had very good understanding of the technology. We were almost mastering it. And we just had to make sure that we change it into flu, into COVID from flu. But we had to deal also with them. I think during that period, there were a ton of collaborations that had to occur. NIH was playing a key role. FDA was playing a key role, because they were the regulator. CDC was playing a key role. So we had to work all together so that we can make sure that we do it fast and we do it well. I remember when there was an important milestone ahead of us that we had to make a submission to FDA so that we can get license to go to the next step. Our science would spend sleepless nights the last week until suddenly in the morning, 5 o'clock, someone will press the button and send the information to FDA, and then they were going to sleep. I knew that a round of sleepless nights for FDA was starting, because their scientists would stay up day and night so that they can turn around the documents that we sent and provide their feedback and their approvals or not on a record time. And so without that, we wouldn't be able to do it. So sometimes I have to say, as heroes, our people were, equally heroes were the people in FDA. And the same applies to NIH, that they were trying to provide their information to us. NIH worked more closely with Moderna because they run a very big part of the studies together. But also, I mean, I was very constantly on the call with Dr. Fauci at the time. To try to make sure that we are aligned in the way that we are developing things.
And so you talk about something that I think is really critical, partnerships, right? So we had NIH, we had FDA, we had the CDC, we had pharma, we had other entities that had, you know, developed the technology and had perfected the technology. And so when we look back now, we know that we were in a crisis mode. What did you learn, and what would you recommend to any of those entities that ask you about how we could improve that partnership such that as we continue to develop drugs and opportunities that make a difference in the lives of people? Right? Because this is about how do we get things to market in an efficient and effective way that is going to improve the lives of people in a preventive strategy and when treatments are needed. What would you recommend that we do differently or that we do in addition to what we're already doing so that we decrease the friction that sometimes limits our opportunities to get drugs to the market in a timely manner?
I think our success that was translated into one of the most profound positive impacts on humans' lives in the last, let's say, decades, or if not ever, creates also responsibilities to us. The responsibility is, if by working together, FDA, CDC, and NIH, we were able to do it for COVID in 9 months, why you should not aim to do it for cancer in 9 months? And that it is what the world is expecting from us. And I repeat, we didn't do it by cutting corners. No one allowed that to happen. We did it by reducing bureaucracy, by putting special effort, because the project was requiring, by putting resources. And that's how things happen. So we need to, instead of looking now to go back to the typical review periods and processes that we had to put aside so that we will move fast, we need to really think how we can go to something that it is in between and will allow serious efforts for serious diseases, and when they are really justified, so breakthrough therapies, that they have some data to back up that they are breakthrough therapies, they will get way, way more attention and acceleration from regulators. I think that's one. Now, going to more general conclusions about pandemic, I think the number one conclusion, but by far supersedes everything, it is the power of science and the value that it brings to society. It's very clear, looking back, that unless there was a life sciences ecosystem that was composed by universities and hospitals that they run the studies,
yes,
by pharmaceutical companies that they organize everything, by biotechs, by regulators, unless we had all of them being at their peak of their scientific performance, we wouldn't be here today. And that gives us the clear recommendation for the future. Let's create an environment that life sciences thrive even more. Let's create an environment through legislations and regulations, and then through active cultural collaborations, make partnerships that will allow, if next pandemic, God forbid, comes, that will find a life sciences ecosystem that it is way stronger than what this one found. So by far, that's one of the most important things.
I was just going to say, I think the world has seen what is possible.
Yeah.
And they will expect for us to deliver differently. And I think we can. And so I wanted to move us to, I think, one of the unfortunate consequences of the pandemic was the incredible amount of misinformation, particularly about the vaccine. You know, one of the things we try to do on the Danforth Dialogues is to stay positive, but also realistic. I know that you recently put on your social media posts in observance of the third anniversary of the vaccine, and you got some negative feedback. Now, as a fellow scientist, I'm not going to repeat any of that because I try not to read it unless it's forced in front of me. But I do want to have a conversation a little bit about how do you suggest that we continue to tackle the misinformation that continues to be put forward about not just the vaccine, but science in general? And how do you individually and you as an organization, Pfizer, want to be a part of solutions that we can create to tackle misinformation?
It is a major issue, and it is a major issue that affected the outcomes of pandemic because of misinformation and disinformation. Hundreds of thousands of people lost lives that they shouldn't. And I think that I make a distinction between misinformation, which is information that it is wrong, is communicated by people that they believe in it, wrongly, but they believe in it, and it could be innocent. They just believe something and they just say it with passion or not. But there is also the disinformation, which is information that it is magnified and circulated, typically from professionals that they know very well that what they are saying is a lie. But they do it, and they are the ones that are feeding the perceptions of other people, either playing with fear, with other basic instincts, and by bombarding in social media typically of wrong and fake news that creates, let's say, this percentage of society that it is completely believing things that they are absolutely not true. And we need to understand that there is a truth, right? And cannot be that the U.S. top scientific information, top scientific governing bodies make some decisions like CDC, FDA. It's not only a CDC, FDA. It is the German authorities, it's the French authorities, the UK authorities, it is the Russian authorities. You can go anywhere in the world, right? I don't think there was a single country, right? And certainly not a single country from the countries that they have any scientific presence in the world that had different opinion on how it needs to be done. And pretty much everybody did the same, right? Because there is a scientific truth, but unfortunately it's lost. So it is not something new, this disinformation. I say it many times that the Holocaust didn't start in Auschwitz. It started with the disinformation that the Nazis' propaganda was circulating that enabled the dehumanization of the Jews and then allowed the German society to accept what happened. It's just that today, because of the way that social media operates, it's way easier for bad actors to do something that before was more challenging. What we need to do it is to raise our voice. It is to stay the course. It is to make the alliance of those that they are committed to the truth, to the scientific truth. We should not undermine the reputation of independent institutions, but it's extremely important that they will be the adjudicators of the scientific truth. We should not undermine the importance of when you speak about scientific information, it needs to be a peer review scientific information and not information that one, even if he's or she is scientist, is circulating. We need to stand up and speak about it. And more importantly, we should not go after the people that truly believe that what they are saying. Someone who is afraid to do vaccines because he or she believes that's dangerous. The worst thing you can do it is to call those people ignorant or fake news or whatever. You need to explain them. They may not get it the first time, they may not get it the second time, but they're human beings. They should eventually come to the right conclusion if you talk to them.
I love how you distinguish between misinformation and disinformation, because what I found, particularly early on, because people of color were disproportionately impacted, that there was so much misinformation. And even though the information was wrong, what I found was it was what people really believed. And they believed it based on the historical context of how they lived, or how their ancestors had lived, or how our ancestors had lived, right? And all of the things that have happened in, you know, medical experimentation with people of color, et cetera. So it was hard for people to grasp that this wasn't something that was, first of all, initiated by some, untoward force that wanted to harm people of color. And then when we saw the disproportionate number of deaths for people of color, of course, that only reinforced the misinformation. But you are correct, I believe, that there's a total difference in disinformation and that it's wrong and it is perpetrated by people who know the truth, but they still continue to perpetrate this information. I believe it is important for us to continue to say that there's a scientific truth and that the only way to counterbalance that is to use our voice and to use our resources. So I will ask you, what is Pfizer doing to address these challenges, particularly the ones I think about that we saw during the pandemic, where communities of color and third world countries continue to face health disparities and gaps in care and opportunities. What is Pfizer doing to address those challenges?
The first thing that you need to do it is to understand the reasons of why this is happening. And then typically what we found, because we did it a lot, is that it's a very complex and multidimensional issue. So you need to tackle every single one of them. We start with, let's say, the disbelief of African Americans in some of the modern medicine and all the legacy problems that we had seen when African Americans have been used in clinical trials, in a terrible way. What we try to do it is to make sure that we, in our clinical trials, we have enough representation of all the minorities as subject of the study, of the clinical trial. Typically, years back, they were all people that they were white, highly educated, middle to high income. We did a lot of effort to make sure that we recruit in our studies African-Americans and Latinos that were the ones that were misrepresented based on their census. And we did very, very well, actually. Across all our studies, we are trying to do that. And we have reached more than 10% now of our subjects in clinical trials in the U.S. are African-Americans, which is huge improvement from 1 or 2% that used to be. So that's one. In COVID particularly, we tried a lot, really we tried a lot, to make sure that we are recruiting people of all neighborhoods, of all walks of life, and particularly for races, and with an emphasis on African-Americans and Latinos. So also we did quite well there. So that's one subject. The second is that we tried to reach to community leaders that they were the ones that could have, after the vaccine was developed, they were the people that the communities were trusting. And they were the ones that they had to see the data and to be convinced that by doctors, right, that that's a good thing. Because if they speak about it, their impact on people is way higher than if we just put ads on the TV or we try to create messages. Or the government, who was doing a lot of that, was trying to say that. Now, when it comes to Africa, for example, or third world countries, that they had also disproportionate access to the available vaccines. Well, it was the opposite over there. Over there, they wanted vaccines and they couldn't get them. That was a problem that in the first 6 months was created because the countries that they were having the manufacturing sites on their territory, they implemented export bans. So we couldn't export from the U.S. until basically May-June anything before we cover all the needs of the U.S. government. India, they did the same, not with us because we were not manufacturing there, but with AstraZeneca, they couldn't export until the end of the year, even worse over there, right? So they wouldn't allow anything to go out. Europe was allowing small portions to go out. And so the first 6 months, we had this challenge. After that, the availability became quite good. And cost was not an issue. We priced our product at tier pricing for the first time so publicly known. So the high-income countries received one price, and that was basically the cost of a takeaway meal. Whatever cost in U.S. or in France, a takeaway meal, that was the cost that was going to cost to get vaccinated. So basically everybody could afford, and everybody was giving it for free from the governments. But with middle-income countries, we were charging half of that. And in the low-income countries, we gave it at cost. And eventually, we did a very big agreement with the Biden administration where we offered 1 billion doses with the cost of the government. They were paying the cost to us, so we're not making money. We're just providing the product. But then they were offering it completely for free to a huge number of countries lower or low-middle-income countries, completely for free. Unfortunately, we realized that equity is on this, on health equity is not only depending on access on medicines, but you need to have access on infrastructure. The uptake of vaccinations in Africa was very, very, very small. Unfortunately, very, very small. And for multiple reasons. One, the same misinformation that existed there. But also in the US, maybe you had to drive 15 minutes to a Walgreens to get your vaccination. In Africa, that could mean walking 7 hours to go somewhere and have to carry also your kids on your So it's this lack of infrastructure, it's unfortunately creating major, major issues. So we need to work on all fronts. We need to make sure that medicines are available, but we need to make sure that doctors, that they know how to use them, are available. We need to make sure that basic infrastructure on health is available, and unfortunately this time, these countries are lacking it.
So you know that Barney Graham is a big advocate for low-income resource countries to be able to develop their own vaccines, to manufacture them, et cetera. Do you see that on the horizon for some of those countries in the next couple of years? Do you see that as a potential?
We did it. We set ourselves, from the early days, a manufacturing facility in South Africa. And our partner, BioNTech, I know they are opening a basic mRNA manufacturing site in Rwanda this month. So,
right.
So it's happening right now. But I'm afraid the sites in South Africa now that produced vaccines, they were not used in Africa. So we had to send them to the high-income countries from there. And we will try to help also produce stuff in Rwanda. But, you know, I think we need to fix the health infrastructure in the low-income countries. And that, I think, should be the first priority rather than to make manufacturing facilities there.
So I hope our audience has enjoyed this part of the conversation, because I really wanted to really get your perspective and your insight into this pandemic, because I definitely think it was a game changer for all of us. And, you know, Danforth Dialogues likes to focus on leadership. So I'm going to end this section of the conversation with asking you, tell me the pick three leadership lessons that you've learned from the pandemic that would be most applicable to the broader scientific community.
Let's see. I think when it comes to leadership, by far, I think I will separate that you will be surprised if you ask a lot from your people how much they can deliver. So the think big. Take courage, right? It's extremely important. I use very often a quote of a philosopher that grew up in the place that I grew up, Aristotle's in Greece, that once he said that our problem is not that we aim high and miss. Our problem is that we aim low and hit. Because when you reduce your targets, even if you're successful, it's worse, because you think that you're doing well. In reality, you're mediocre, and you could have done way more. So number one lesson, it is, you will be surprised how much people can deliver if you ask them. So that's, I think, by far the number one. There are other things that are coming together. I mean, sometimes what looks the obvious choice is not necessarily the best. So before you make a decision, try to make sure that you challenge all the assumptions. We would never go for mRNA if we were taking the obvious choice. Pfizer was very good in doing adenovirus technologies, conjugate technologies, protein vaccines, all of that, right? We were the one that was most uncertain and the more counterintuitive was mRNA. So it was the less obvious, but it was the most successful. So try to do that. And then during that, it's more, I don't know if it's a lesson, it's likely a lesson to avoid. during those times, I was pressing a lot my people to deliver. And I think they were fine with that, although the pressure was tremendous. But there were some times that I lost it because the stress was very high and things were at stake. And then I was my frustration would lead me to down to people or in front of others, etc. At the end of the day, because we were successful, they forgave me for doing that. But I don't think they ever forgotten that I did that. So it's a good thing to try to avoid doing these things next time.
An insightful leader and some insightful comments. It also, I think, shows sometimes that we too as leaders are human and we are vulnerable. And I do think it was a lot of stress for all of us at that time. And I do think it mattered, Albert, that we were successful. If we were not successful, we probably wouldn't be on this podcast right now. So congratulations to you and your team. So let me sort of shift gears. I think that almost all of our guests on the Danforth Dialogues will point to their family history and formative years as having a big impact on their lives and success. You are one of my first guests who can state that you are a descendant of Holocaust survivors. So I would be interested to know how that impacts you in your leadership style and in your day-to-day operations, particularly when we are dealing with so much challenges in this country around anti-Semitism. And I am concerned, like you, how we address this. So how do you, who you are, who you've become, how did your family history impact that?
Like everyone, the family that you are growing up is shaping a very big part of our personality. It is the school, it is the friends, but family is the foundation, and for good or for bad. So we are what the family environment made us during the early stages of our life. In my case, it was not only that they were Holocaust survivors. It was not the only one thing, right? We were a middle-income family. We were not very affluent, but it's not that nothing was missing from the table. My parents were loving each other. They were loving us. So all of that was a very positive thing for me. Now, when it comes to their experience, particularly my mom's experience as a survivor, first of all, she was talking to us about that a lot. Many survivors never talk to their children about the horrors they lived because it was too painful and it was a strange psychology. But my mom was talking to me a lot, and to my sister and our cousins. The thing that I'm grateful is that she never talked to us about hate or revenge. She didn't explaining how she was abused in the jail and how she escaped the last moment from the firing squad and how she was beaten and all of that, right? And saying, one day you need to pay back those that they did that to us. Never, right? She was mostly using that to teach me and my sister that don't get disappointed from the adversity of life, because life is miraculous. So she would use this thing that she escaped last moment, the firing squad said, it was almost certain that I'm going to be dead. And look who I am now. I have you and we have a great family. So that gave me clearly a sense of optimism, so which I transfer until now. So I always see the glass half full, rather than half empty. And I think that comes from the lessons that I learned from my mom.
I love that. My team will tell you I talk about the glass half full all the time. And I will steal your quote from your mom. Life is miraculous. And I think, you know, being in places and spaces when we get to sit in a seat, we get to control assets, we get to influence people, we get to develop and ask people to bring their best self to work. And if we are insightful leaders, we recognize that that is what leads to greatness for individuals and then for companies. So tell me what kind of company you would like Pfizer to be known as in the next 5 to 10 years.
Look, I would like a company that it is brave, it is focused, it is compassionate, and it is spirited. I want people to be happy here. And that's the culture that we try to create. I want people to know us as someone like that, but also to remember us as someone that had a tremendous positive impact on the world. And I think our successes with COVID gave us already a position in the Hall of Fame of the companies that had a tremendous impact on people's lives. So for us, the challenge is, I want to do it once more. And I think our best bet to do it right now probably will be with cancer. This is where most of our investments go. This is where we are selecting the brightest to act. This is where the need of the world is tremendous. So I hope that in addition to remember for doing things in COVID, we'll remember for making cancer a chronic disease rather than a death sentence.
That would be welcome. That would be definitely welcome. And I will ask you, what do you see on the horizon, particularly in the space of AI or other enabling technologies that may help us to get there faster? How do you see us incorporating, say, like AI into our strategies to make cancer a chronic disease that we can diagnose sooner, manage, create the right medications, improve people's life expectancy and quality of life?
I think AI will be transformative for life sciences. And will allow us to live a scientific renaissance of medical advancements, not only because we have significant improvements in our understanding of biology, but also because we have significant technological improvements, including AI, that will enable things to go way, way higher. As a result, we will be able to see, moving from drug discovery, when you try to discover among million molecules the one that works, into drug design, when AI will allow you to design a drug that believes will have better chances to be successful. We'll have clinical trials that will be way more focused. We will have manufacturing yields that will be way better. So everything that we do can be improved. And as a result, we should see more, better medicines faster. Now, clearly, AI is very powerful. And when you have a very powerful tool, you know that in the hands of bad people can do bad things. And clearly, we should have regulations around it and create a framework that will try to minimize this. But at the same time, we should try to have regulation that also makes easier AI in the hands of good people to do good things. Because really, we are speaking about tremendous advancements that will allow us to do things for the betterment of mankind that we couldn't without it.
And so, Avery, you talked about this earlier when you were building the team to tackle the challenges with the vaccine. And you talked about having different experts, different people with different skill sets, different perspectives on the team. So tell me how inclusion will play a role for us to achieve equity and increase the opportunities for drug discovery, drug design, particularly when we have to deal with social media, when we have to deal with misinformation, disinformation, and new tools like AI. How can inclusion play a role to help us to potentially achieve new opportunities?
It's tremendous. The role is very significant and very important. And I try to explain to everyone who is asking me the difference between diversity and inclusion, because one thing it is to have diverse teams and that they have different opinions, different views, different cultures, different ways of thinking, different legacies, which means different races, different sexual orientations, different gender, different nationalities, all of that. It's good to have it, but unless if you create an environment that they feel included, an environment that they can thrive, an environment that they can come in and feel that they belong rather than they are, let's say, the poor relative, then you are not achieving anything. So inclusion is extremely important. We need to make sure that everybody feels in the groups that we in our working teams that belongs, is part of the family, and there are not rich or poor members in this family. They're a family, right? So that's I think, one of the most important. Now, overall, in the world right now, I think we have this almost an epidemic of exclusion. And people are excluded of several things that are happening, either because of their economic inclusion, so they don't have the money, and as a result, they don't have access to several good things. We have social exclusion. We see people bullied and then don't feel included in school or in society. We have racial, of course, exclusion that exists. So it's extremely important if we want to make a better world, that all people need to feel that they are equal children under this sun, right? So there are a lot of things that we can do. Suddenly, in the last few years, it is expected from corporations to take way more aggressive stance and actually to take position and opinions on that. From one hand, this is good because the credibility of corporations is very high, unlike the credibility of politicians, by the way. And when you have high credibility, that's why they are asking you to take the step and drive good things. But I think in a society, it's not us that we are not elected officials to lead the opinion. We should say our position and we should say our opinion. Okay, but I would prefer to see an upgrade on the political on the political forces of this and country and of the world, that they will speak more credible about those topics.
So, thank you for, I think, that very thoughtful comment, because I really do believe you started off talking about leaders listening and building teams. And you sort of come full circle about who needs to be a part of that team if we really are going to live up to the expectations and, I think, deliver the promise of science. And that's what this is about. So I hope the audience has appreciated this conversation with Dr. Agret Burla today. Thank you for joining us. It's really important that on behalf of everyone on the planet, that we thank you for your leadership and commitment to helping develop the vaccines that mitigated COVID-19 and the pandemic. And as always, in closing, we offer three thoughts on leadership. Our first thought today is that great leaders know when they have to put all their chips on the table. And Agret said something early on that we all had to be all in. It wasn't just about the money, but we had to all bring our best self to the table every day. It's sort of human nature to be a bit cautious and conservative, particularly in the face of challenging circumstances that appear to be overwhelming. But great leaders like Dr. Birla can recognize when they have to go all in or it's all over. And thank goodness they have the courage to do it. And I will say putting down $2 billion on a bet on a new vaccine platform was something that showed that Pfizer was all in. It made a difference for all of us. Secondly, great leaders understand that the glass isn't half empty. It's actually half full. Dr. Birla's commitment to inclusion recognizes the fundamental truth that societies that focus on unity are more successful than those that focus on division. As Abraham Lincoln said long ago, a country, a government, a company, a school, a neighborhood, or a family cannot stand if it's divided against itself. Trying to include all people doesn't lessen the influence for some people. It actually creates more opportunities for everyone. And finally, great leaders stay above the fray. I don't know if Dr. Birla expected the reaction he received from his social media posting celebrating the 3-year anniversary of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, but I did notice that he nor his company had reactions to the comments. And I appreciated that. Great leaders know when it's time to let others say what they want to say while they concentrate on doing what they need to do to move their organizations and their industries forward. It matters to stay above the fray. So thank you, Dr. Birla, for staying above the fray and staying focused on the opportunities that Pfizer can create and help us deliver this promise of science to everyone. Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me, Valerie. It was a great honor and a great pleasure to have this discussion with you.
Again, thank you to our listeners for this edition of Danforth Dialogue. We hope that you will see that over the next year in 2024, we're going to have some incredible guests. We always wish you good health and great success in all you do.
This has been a presentation of Danforth Dialogues with Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more information, please contact us at danforthdialogues@msm.edu.